What happens when your faith clashes with the culture in which you live? What happens when your faith clashes with the laws of the land in which you live? What happens when what you believe is not politically correct? We all have some sense of that already. Even in our country, we can name a couple of examples. For example, most Christians oppose the very concept of abortion, believing that a child, even within the mother's womb, is still a child. And yet, in most places in our country, abortion is legal and supported, and you're considered, at the very least, politically incorrect. And if you get very vociferous about it, very outspoken about it, even you sound like you're advocating that people are doing something wrong when they're doing what the law allows. Same is true in the area of what's called gay rights and the rights of those who have this sexual orientation, are advocating and are being given the right in many places now to marry. And yet most Christians oppose that on moral and ethical grounds. And we come in clash and in conflict with not only our culture, but the laws of the land. We're not actually advocating that someone break the law, but just because it has become the law in some places, we would say doesn't mean that makes it right, morally or ethically. And so we're starting to feel the effects of this. And yet, as we look in our study this morning in Acts chapter 17, we see that it goes far beyond that. What the early Christians found and what the early missionaries found is that what they were teaching and advocated was actually seen not just as contrary to what the culture accepted and contrary to what the law accepted, but they will actually end up being accused of breaking the law by advocating the basic principles of Christianity. Now certainly, this is something that happened even in the days of Jesus. He was accused of breaking the law when he wouldn't submit to their traditions about the Sabbath day, for example. But he told his followers that as they went out preaching the good news about him, they would find themselves hauled in front of magistrates and kings and judges. They'll find themselves being beaten and cast into prison and even killed if they continued to preach what he was sending them out to preach. And while one of the earliest persecutors of Christians was a man by the name of Saul of Tarsus, he actually carried Christians before magistrates and threw them into prison and oversaw them being executed for their faith. He actually became a Christian and then suffered the very things that he had brought upon others. And Jesus even told him on the road to Damascus when he had appeared to him and told him, I'm going to show you how much you must suffer for my sake. And so that's really a part of the story we see as we're studying the life of the Apostle Paul. As we now are into what's called his second missionary journey, as he had left the productive work in Antioch, where he had been involved with Barnabas for a number of years, and has gone off through Cilicia and up into Pisidia, revisiting the churches that he had earlier founded in the preaching of the gospel and had suffered persecution when he had been there. And then he and Silas and Timothy had gotten on this great trade road that traveled from Tarsus and parts further east, and it traveled west and northwest until you got to the very shores of the Adriatic Sea, a part of the Mediterranean. And when that road comes to an end at the docks in Troas, it was expected that you would get on a boat and travel across the Adriatic to land on the shores of Macedon or Macedonia. And in fact, when they get to Troas, Paul has a vision at night in which a man from Macedonia appears in this dream and says, come over and help us. It's a very interesting statement. The man from Macedonia in this vision doesn't say, come over and preach the gospel to us. Come over and tell us about Jesus Christ. Doesn't say, come over and help us to be saved. He says, come over and help us. What our world doesn't often realize, and what unfortunately we don't often realize, is when we tell people about Jesus Christ and about God's love and about being free from sin and saved and having life after this life, we're helping them. Even if the culture is trying to prevent us from doing that, even if the law is trying to prevent us from doing that, and while we still enjoy at least the law's protection as we do that in our nation, there are other parts of our world where that's not the case. Perhaps you realize that in the nation of China, to preach the gospel is viewed as a threat to the government. Because in China, people are taught that the ultimate authority is the government, not God. And so if you tell people that there's a higher authority than the government that they must answer to, and that your allegiance needs to be to this higher authority, even if that should at some point come in conflict with the government, that's not viewed kindly in China. And Christians suffer there. That's what they're facing in this period of time as well. The Roman Empire was by this time premised on the idea that not just the government, but the emperor himself is the ultimate authority. And they had even developed this idea in Roman culture that the emperor, because he's the ultimate authority, is actually, in some sense, divine, deity himself. The worship of the old gods of the Romans, of Jupiter and Saturn and all of those things, had passed into the background. It was still practiced, but it was at a very low level. Now, most people, if they really were religious, worship the emperor. In every city, there were altars set up where people at least once a year were called upon to come and bow down and offer an offering and praise the wonderfulness of the emperor as God. The coins that they used in everyday commerce would have stamped on them the image of the emperor. And on one side it would say, Lord God the Emperor. And on the other side it would say, the High Priest and God. That's their view of the emperor. So if you're starting to preach that even the emperor answers to somebody higher than himself, and if you start to tell people that even if you're in good graces with the emperor and his government, but your sins have not been forgiven by Almighty God, then that to many people sounds like a conflict with what their whole culture was built upon. And it was. We saw at the end of Acts chapter 16 that when Paul and Silas and Timothy and Luke came into Philippi, the very first place they went to preach the gospel after this vision of the man from Macedonia saying, come over and help us. They did cross over that Adriatic Sea from Troas over to the seacoast port of Philippi and then traveled on up to Philippi in Acts chapter 16. And Philippi was a very, really unique place. There were almost no Jewish people who lived there. A big part of the reason for that is that the city of Philippi in New Testament times was almost entirely Roman in population. It had been made a free city by the Roman emperor, so they didn't pay taxes. Most of the people who lived there were retired civil servants and military people out of the Roman government and out of the Roman army. And their devotion above anywhere else almost in the empire, even in Rome itself, they were more devoted to the worship of the emperor than almost anywhere else in the whole Roman Empire, in Philippi. There were a few Jewish people who did live there, but they weren't even enough to build a Jewish synagogue, and so they worshiped outside of the city, down by the riverside. And that's where Paul and Silas go on the first Sabbath day to find a few Jewish people there and others who were attracted to the faith of the Jews, where they were meeting, mostly women. And it's there that they convert their first person to faith in Jesus Christ. Her name was Lydia. She and her household, her family, her servants, all became Christians. And from that point forward, she insisted that Paul and the others use her house as their place to stay while they were in Philippi. As they continued to preach the gospel in Philippi, it doesn't mention that they had a tremendous response to the gospel. But there was response, a positive one. But also, in the course of things, Paul ends up casting a demon out of a young woman who was following them around. She had this this spirit of divination, the same kind of divination or foretelling the future that the oracles at Delphi, which were very famous in that part of the world in that time, had. And she apparently had that same particular kind of spirit. And she, because she was a slave girl, was owned by some men who used her to make a great deal of money for themselves, selling her services. But as soon as she sees Paul and the others, that spirit inside of her starts crying out, saying that these men are servants of the Most High God who are telling you the way to be saved. Now, in one way, that's not what the devil wants to tell anybody, but he is compelled by God's superior nature over him to say that. Just like several times demons said that of Jesus when they came in contact with him. Well, after several days of this, it says that Paul became irritated, troubled. It says in most of our translations, but the Greek word is actually irritated. We really don't need the devil preaching the gospel for us, do we? And in fact, there's a real danger in having someone who is under the control of the devil even saying true things, because if they ever start saying false things, people are going to be just as misled by that as it would by the being led by the true thing. So Paul actually casts the demon out of her. She's free. But not everybody's thrilled to get the devil kicked out of them. We still have a lot of people in our world today who wants the devil in them. And these men have lost their means of income. And yet that's sort of a intangible kind of thing, you know. You can't exactly go to the judge and say, I want these men arrested because they cast something invisible out of this girl that we own. And now she can't do what she used to do, and so we can't make our living. That's a pretty intangible kind of thing. And so instead they go to the authorities and say, these men are Jews. Now that's true. Paul and Silas were Jews, but they weren't teaching Judaism. But they say, these men are Jews, and they're teaching things that if we obey them would be illegal for us as Romans to do. Now, the Jews enjoyed an unusual status in their culture. They had won some concessions from the Roman government way back in the days of Julius Caesar and then later of Caesar Augustus. And those were still standing, those rights were still standing in Paul's day. And the rights that Jews had won was this. They didn't have to make those sacrifices to the emperor. Now, the Jews had that right not to make those sacrifices. But if they tried to tell other people not to do it, that was breaking the law. So these men are accusing Paul and Silas as Jews of advocating that others do something that would actually be breaking the law. Well, they don't have their religion quite straight because they don't realize that it's actually Paul and Silas aren't teaching Judaism, but they're teaching the gospel about Jesus Christ. Now, the gospel about Jesus Christ was also teaching that Caesar was not God and that we should not bow the knee to Caesar as God, but rather to Jesus. That's what they were really teaching. But they're actually being accused of teaching Judaism. Who cares if, you know, for the sake of the argument, the authority didn't care whether they had their theology exactly right or not about what Paul and Silas were teaching. The end result would be the same. They immediately have these men arrested and thrown into jail. It seems that would then give the authorities time to decide what charges exactly to press against them and what they want to do about them. So they have them thrown in jail. That night, Paul and Silas are singing and praying in the prison. The other prisoners are listening to what they're praying about and what they're singing about and are probably being influenced by that in a positive way. We don't even know what the other prisoners are in there for. Some of them probably for being pickpockets or thieves, and others for extortion and maybe even for murder and different kinds of things. But there's an earthquake, a violent earthquake, so much so that the actual iron gates of the prison cells are popped open and the walls are cracked where the prisoners' chains are fastened into the walls, and they would actually be free to walk out should they choose to do so. And though we're not told it, but it seems evident that when that happened, Paul and Silas must have shouted out to the other prisoners not to do anything. Within moments, or at least minutes, the jailer, the man in charge of this jail, comes in with his soldiers and with a light, because it's total darkness in there at night, And he thinks his prisoners have escaped, and under Roman law, if you're someone like a jailer and your prisoners under your charge escape, you're held accountable and will be executed. So he's going to kill himself. That'd be less painful than what they would do to him. When Paul stops him from doing that, saying, we're all still here. This man is quite shaken by the whole affair. He's apparently has heard what Paul and Silas have been preaching even before they were thrown in jail. He's seen what they did in casting out the spirit out of this girl, and now there's been this earthquake. They're in jail. The earthquake has opened the prison door so they could escape. I think he takes all of that as signs from some higher power that these men are from God. So he brings them into his own house, washes their stripes, so they've been beaten before they've been thrown into jail, and asks them, what must I do to be saved? That's a very word the girl with the demon had earlier said, that these are servants of the Most High God telling us what we must do to be saved. He says, I want to be saved. We don't know what was on his conscience. We don't know what was so obvious in his own mind that he needed to be have his sins forgiven. But he wants to be saved. And so they preach the gospel to him and his family. And that same night, their stripes are washed and his sins are washed away. And he, along with Lydia's family, become core parts of the church in Philippi. Well, the next morning, the authorities have made the decision that we'll just, you know, rather than cause a lot of trouble, we'll just ban these men. We'll escort them out of town and tell them they can't come back. So they send word down to the jailer to set these men free and take them outside of town and tell them they're banned from the city. Well, this would put the church, the little church in Philippi, in a bad light. It would mean that this little church was started by men who are considered outlaws, criminals, been kicked out of town, bad reputation, bad name. And no Roman would want to be a part of something like that. And so instead, Paul says, tell them that we're Roman citizens, and they violated our rights as Romans. Because every Roman had the right to be questioned and examined and not beaten until he had actually faced a judge and found guilty of something. Now, the Romans reserved the right to beat anybody else, almost without provocation. But if you were actually a Roman citizen, you could not be treated that way. You had your civil rights. And they had not even bothered the day before to ask if these men were Roman citizens or not. And Paul and Silas had not volunteered that information. But now Paul says, we're Roman citizens. Suddenly that puts the authorities over the city of Philippi in a difficult situation. They have violated Roman citizens' rights. They could be dismissed from their positions of authority by the Roman government for having done this. And so they come down to the prison and they escort Paul and Silas out. They issue, in effect, an apology. And they beg them to go on their way. Now see what this has done. It means that at any point in the future, at least as long as these present rulers over Philippi are in office, if they ever step out of line and mistreat these Christians in Philippi, Paul and Silas might show up again and still press charges against them. It's a kind of subtle form of blackmail. Paul has them in a difficult situation, and it really protects the church in Philippi, really helps the church there. It caused the authorities to choose to sort of turn a blind eye to this church because they didn't want Paul to show back up again and get them in more trouble. But he's left. He goes on his way, and it tells us at the beginning of chapter 17 that when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. Remember, there wasn't one in Philippi. Not enough Jews there to have one. But there's something, a couple of other things have also happened here. We notice that if we start chapter 17, it talks about what they were doing. What does that mean? It means Luke stayed behind in Philippi. When they were leaving Troas to go over to Philippi, it was what we were doing. But now as Paul and Silas and Timothy have left Philippi, heading towards Thessalonica, it's talking in the third person. This means Luke stayed behind in Philippi. And in fact, this speaking in the third person indicating that Luke is not with Paul, continues all the way until in Paul's third missionary journey, several years in the future from now, he will be coming back through Philippi. And as he leaves Philippi to go back over to Troas on that third journey, it switches back from they to we again. Apparently, Luke spends the next several years in Philippi ministering with the church and their evangelism and all of that there. A little thing we only deduce it by the way the language is written and not by anything Luke actually says about himself. He tells us practically nothing about himself. But meanwhile, he's been left behind, and it'll only be later as he gets these details from Paul and perhaps Silas, he can write this portion of Acts. But as they left Philippi, they're traveling down what's called the Ignatian Way. This was a major trade road that had been built originally in the days of the Greeks and then expanded and so forth in the days of the Romans to make it easier for troops and supplies and other things to pass through this part of the world. And so they're traveling down the Ignatian Way that travels from Philippi down along the coastline and passes through these two smaller cities of Amphipolis and Apollonia and goes on down to Thessalonica and then from there travels on down into another part of Greece. And in fact, this road actually forms a main street that passed through Thessalonica in New Testament times. And they chose not to stop at these two places, and yet Luke, as he tells us in just a single sentence, in a single verse, has just told us that Paul has traveled 100 miles. Because the distance from Philippi through Apollonia and Amphipolis down to Thessalonica is almost exactly 100 miles in our way of measure. Each of these places, Amphipolis and Apollonia, were about a day's travel by walking from each other. So they probably traveled from Philippi to Amphipolis, spent the night, got up the next day. Well, they did not even preach the gospel there. Went on down to Apollonia, spent the night there. And then from Apollonia on down to Thessalonica was about another 33 miles, and so they would have made Thessalonica by that night, probably. So when they get to Thessalonica, there is a Jewish synagogue there. Thessalonica actually had a large Jewish population. And sometimes in its history, as much as 50% of the population was Jewish. I don't know exactly how large it was in New Testament times. I just recently read that even today, the town that exists there today, about 15% of the population even today is Jewish. It just seemed to be one of those places where for a long, long time, a significant number of Jewish people lived. Thessalonica couldn't be more different than Philippi. It was mostly Greek and Jewish. Much smaller number of Romans actually lived there. Thessalonica is one of those early places where democracy flourished. Thessalonica was ruled by those people who had the right to vote would choose their own city leaders. They actually chose two groups of people. They chose an assembly of 50 to 100 people who would meet regularly to decide things that had to do with the welfare and the laws and so forth of the city. And then out of that group of 50 to 100 people or so, 5 to 7 men would be selected who were called politarchs. They were actually the overseers of the city. This was all done by democracy. And the Roman government had let this stand. Now, these men, these politarchs, could still lose their position if they didn't keep Roman law and so forth, but they actually were selected and ruled by popular consent. And that's about to come into play into our story today. When they got to the Thessalonica, it says, as his custom was, Paul went into the synagogue, and on 3 Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead, and saying, this Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. Remember, one of the real issues for Saul of Tarsus, before he had become a Christian, was that Jesus could not be the Messiah because he had been crucified. The Jewish thinking in Jesus' day was that the Messiah, prophesied in the Old Testament, was going to be a king and a military leader. So how can you talk to us about him being crucified and killed? They couldn't, in their own mind, marry those two ideas from Old Testament prophecy together. Most of them had ended up with an idea that there were going to be two who would come. One was going to be the Messiah, who would be the king and military leader, and a second one was going to come that they called the suffering servant, who was going to be the one who was going to die for their sins. They pictured two different people. It turns out that Jesus was saying, and now the gospel was saying, they're both the same person. That the same one who was the Messiah and going to be king also was going to be the suffering servant who would die. And people say, well, how can he be king if he's going to die? And that was the genius of God's plan. God's going to raise him from the dead. Not only would that allow him to be both, it would also provide the most compelling evidence that he was from God. Because no one rises from the dead. And the only way that could even be possible is if God did it. That's what finally convinced Saul of Tarsus. When he met on the road to Damascus a living Jesus who he knew for a fact had been executed. But here he is alive. There's only one conclusion that could be made. He's been raised from the dead. The very thing the Christians had already been preaching. Now he starts preaching it. And when he gets to Thessalonica, he goes to the Jewish community there, and that's what for 3 weeks he preaches to them. Four different words are used to describe what he's doing. It says that he reasoned with them. That is, he tried to logically, clearly lay out what the Scriptures teach on this. He reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining, which means he helps them understand how this could work, and proving. Those are all different ideas, aren't they? Reasoning, explaining, and proving. He's presenting the evidence for it, that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. He shows them how that's what the Scriptures taught, so it had to happen. And then he points out that is exactly what did happen. And even telling them, this Jesus I am proclaiming. There's his fourth word. Reasoning, explaining, proving, and proclaiming. This Jesus I am proclaiming to you is the Christ. That's his conclusion. Some of the Jews were persuaded. Notice the word some. That means not a whole lot, but some. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks. In most communities where there were Jewish synagogues, Greek people particularly were impressed by what the Jews believed. And more than a few of them wanted to know more about it and would actually start attending synagogue services. And the Jewish people thought of themselves as actually being the light of the world because they were teaching these Greeks about the Jewish faith. And these God-fearing Greeks, as they're called, were those who hadn't actually converted to Judaism, but they were attracted to the idea of the Jewish faith that there's only one supreme God and that He is active in our world. That was all very different than what their own Greek theology was all about. And they were attracted to that. But we find out here, as Paul is doing this for 3 weeks, a few of the Jews are persuaded, but a large number of the Greeks who had been coming to synagogue are persuaded, and not a few prominent women. That's just sort of a backhanded way of saying also a large number, even of very influential women in the city, probably wives of Polytarchs and so forth. These were in that upper strata of the society of the city. So what this means is right away in Thessalonica, a few Jews, but a lot of Greeks and prominent women become Christians. But the Jews were jealous. Now, in one way, if we think about that, we know how we struggle to have visitors here who will keep coming and learn the gospel about Jesus and become Christians and a part of us here. What if someone start visiting here and then suddenly we realize they're busy talking to the people who are visiting here and are winning them away? I don't think we'd be very happy about that. That's how the Jews are viewing what Paul is doing. Now, from Paul's standpoint, he would say, no, no, no. He says, what you yourselves as Jews stand for is what we stand for. It's just you haven't taken it the next step. We're going ahead and taking it the next step. What you exist and hope for has come. And that's what we're teaching you and these people. And they've responded to that even if you haven't. So the Jews became jealous because it's taking away the very people who were coming to their synagogues. The Jews were jealous. But are they going to go to the authorities and say, look, these men are proselyting our converts? No, that won't stand up in any court of law. People have a right to believe what they want. So instead, they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. Then in the marketplace, the agora, there were these day workers that would just hang around, that maybe somebody would pay them to haul freight in or out of the marketplace, or maybe needed somebody for the day to go out and work on their estate or something, and so they would be hired. They're, not very classy type individuals, at least some of them, and it caused them bad characters. And the Jews actually go to these men, they're using underhanded subterfuge, and pay these fellows to start a riot. And the riot is against Paul and Silas. And what's the riot about? They formed a mob and started a riot in the city. They rushed to Jason's house, who we haven't met until now, but it turns out this is a place apparently where Paul and Silas were staying while they were in Thessalonica. Rushed to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. What do you think would happen if they had found them there and brought them out? They'd probably beat them to death before the authorities could show up to stop them. This is mob action. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other brothers before the city officials shouting. So they drag Jason, this man who owned this house where they went to look for Paul and Silas, and some others of these new converts down before the city officials, or actually it says in the Greek, the politarchs, which indicates that Luke knew exactly what kind of government they had in Thessalonica. Very few cities had this form of government. And Thessalonica is one of the few places archaeologists even today in the ruins of ancient Thessalonica have found arches of the ancient city that have carved on them that this arch was built by or donated by during the reign or the rule of so-and-so Polytarch of Thessalonica. So they know they had this unique form of government that didn't exist in most places. But they dragged them before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here, and Jason has welcomed them into his house." These rioters who are being instigated by the Jews are admitting that the gospel is a powerful message and that it's actually changing people. They're turning the world upside down, in effect, they're saying, with this message. And they've gone before the city officials and they're saying that this Jason has welcomed them into his house. And they are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus. The emperors were very paranoid people, especially when we move to this part of New Testament times, because after we had Caesar Augustus, we suddenly had great upheaval in the emperor's palace. We had, over the course of the next several years, we had Caligula, who reigned for only 4 years and was a crazy man, was assassinated by his own guards because of that. And then he was replaced by his uncle, who was emperor for about 14 years. And then he was assassinated and was replaced by another nice, benevolent fellow by the name of Nero, who reigned for about 14 years before he took his own life, before it was taken for him. And then after he died, then in 1 year we had 4 different men who all claimed to be emperor, before things sort of settled back down again. So these emperors were paranoid people. If anybody else shows up saying, "I'm emperor, I'm king," everybody in the whole Roman Empire was told that it was your first responsibility. You hear of anybody claiming to be an emperor or a king, you report that to the authorities so they can do something about it. And of course, what is the message of the gospel? It is that Jesus Christ is king, that he is a king that was prophesied in the Old Testament, God's king. But it is interesting that they say here that there is another king. But the word "another" there in the Greek is heteros, which means a different kind of king. They're acknowledging that he's a different kind of king. He's not one who sits on a physical throne in a physical capital city somewhere ruling over a physical empire. They're admitting that, and yet still just to say he's claiming to be king is enough to get everybody all upset. And especially the Polytarchs, if there's this huge crowd who showed up here and demanding they do something about these men. Remember, these men hold their position because they've been elected by this very crowd and others like them to their positions. So they feel a close affinity to doing whatever this crowd wants them to do because they could be voted right out of office in short order if they don't. They're supposed to be their representatives. When they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil. Then they made Jason and the others post bond and let them go. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. Apparently, some of the brethren had hidden Paul and Silas. That's why they couldn't find them at Jason's house. But as soon as it got to be dark, they concluded it was just too dangerous for Paul and Silas to stay there. And so they smuggled them out of the city and sent them on their way. But the church has begun in Thessalonica. One little last thing I'll tell you about Jason. His name shows up again later in Romans chapter 16. And Paul says that Jason was actually one of his relatives. Isn't that interesting? When Paul got to Thessalonica, he hunted up one of his cousins, who knows what. And that's who he was staying with, and that was one of the converts. And Jason actually takes the heat for Paul here at this point. You see what's happening? In order for people to become Christians, they have to be willing to go against their culture. They have to be willing to believe something that is going to throw them in conflict with even their own government. But they were willing to do that because the evidence was there. Remember what it said. Paul reasoned with them and explained to them and proved to them. And so there was the evidence. Now, that didn't turn the Christians in Thessalonica into revolutionaries who were trying to overthrow the Roman government. Far from it. But it does mean that they suffered a great deal for their faith. A few months later, Paul, as he leaves Thessalonica, will go on down to Berea, which we'll read about next time. And then from there, we'll go on to Athens. And after being there, we'll go on to Corinth. And he'll spend a year and a half in Corinth, being able to preach the gospel there. But while he's in Corinth, he will write two letters back to the church in Thessalonica. We call them 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. It's some of the earliest letters we have of the Apostle Paul. And they were written very close in time to when the church was first established there. And so it's very enlightening for us to read those two letters knowing that Paul is writing them just a few months or at the most a year or so after he had first been there and preached the gospel. And he was very proud in the right kind of way of what effect the gospel had had on them. But in a sense, it actually had too good an effect. Because as he had talked to them while he had been there about the fact that this Jesus, who is now king, is coming back again, some of them took that so much to heart that they stopped working and quit their jobs and started waiting for Jesus to come back. And he had to set them straight about that the time is not yet for him to come back. And that they needed to continue to work and provide for their families and be good citizens until he did come. That's part of the corrective teaching that we find in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. So in effect, his message was a little bit not fully understood, and it actually had too much of an effect on some of them. But he found in the Thessalonians, just like he did in the Philippians, some people that later he would describe them as saying, they are my joy and my crown. He said that of the Philippians. He said that of the Thessalonians. They brought great joy to his heart to even remember the time he had spent with them. And he considered them his crown in the sense that that's where, from a gospel standpoint, he had actually won a victory. And so he was wearing the crown of a victor in them. Well, you need to realize even today as we support men and women like Jack O'Conn and the Conways and Jerry Pruitt and the Heinemanns and the Ukraine and whoever else we might from time to time have the opportunity to support. And most people go out preaching the gospel, they may very well be putting their lives in jeopardy. And even if their life per se is not in jeopardy, their lives have been changed. So it's not like ordinary people who don't do this kind of thing. They pay a great price to preach the gospel. But they do it so more and more people can be saved. It's like Paul and Silas are doing here. We have an invitation song that invites us to think about what effect the gospel has on our life and whether we're really letting it have its full effect. And if any of us need to respond to the gospel in any way, you can do it now while we stand up and sing the song.